This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, from New York to San Francisco and Toronto to St. Louis, equipment trucks loaded with bats, gloves, and bubble gum set out for spring training camps in Florida and Arizona. Pitchers and catchers report in a matter of days, followed by left fielders, second basemen, and various other component parts, making up the most expensive major league teams ever. Joining me now to discuss the baseball landscape is Tim Kirkjian of ESPN. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Unhappily, we have to start with a story that's dominating the baseball news these days, Jose Canseco's assertions regarding steroid use in major league locker rooms. How do you rate Mr. Canseco's credibility?
Bill, it's not very high. Remember, this is the guy who denied for years ever doing steroids.
Mm-hmm.
And now he says that he did it, and so did a bunch of other people. Now, let's not forget, of course, that we are in a steroid era here. It's clear there has been a steroid problem in baseball. However, I just need to hear somebody other than Jose Canseco. I need another source on this saying, yes, I saw so-and-so doing such a thing, because we just can't believe very much from Jose Canseco right now. And when some of the denials have come out, including from Rafael Palmeiro being so vehement, it makes you wonder, is this guy really right about this? And you have to be right about this before you're going to make an accusation of this magnitude.
Among those implicated by Canseco is Jason Giambi of the Yankees. Giambi held a press conference this week during which he apologized to everybody, but he wasn't specific about what he was apologizing for. What did you make of that performance?
Well, I thought it was just his way of saying, I'm sorry. I think it was his way of saying, let's leave my teammates out of this. This is my problem. Do not bother them in spring training. Let's not make this a spring training issue. Let's get it over with now. Of course, it's not over now. It won't be over for a really long time. His teammates will be bothered by this no matter what. And I think him not using the word steroid was done for a variety of reasons. And I think number one being, if he comes out and acknowledges that he did steroids, it's possible that the Yankees would have a little bit of ammunition then to try to void that contract. And right now, they don't have very much ammunition other than what was in the grand jury testimony, which is apparently sealed at this point, and they can't get to that.
Let's get on to some actual baseball talk now. Perhaps the most expensive preseason signing occurred when the Mets acquired Carlos Beltran, who has a multi-year contract worth $119 million. And he's not the only new Met. Is this team suddenly a contender?
You know, I don't think so, Bill. I still think they're the fourth best team in their own division, and they've got a long way to go still. However, they did have the best offseason of any team out there. They got arguably the best free agent pitcher available in Pedro Martinez. They definitely got the best free agent player available in Carlos Beltran. I think they overpaid for both of them. However, they have to do something. They were a desperate club that needed to get back in the race and get back on the back pages in New York, and I think they did the latter. However, I don't think they're a contender either in the division or for the wild card at this point, but they are demonstrably better than they were at the end of last year.
Sammy Sosa, long the franchise in Chicago, is an Oriole now. I hope the Orioles don't think he can pitch.
Well, they need him to pitch, Bill, and he's not going to pitch. What he's going to do, though, much like Martinez and Beltran in New York, is he's going to put people in the stands at Camden Yards, which, again, is absolutely imperative at this point because, A, they're in the same division as the Yankees and the Red Sox, and they're not going to the playoffs as long as they're in that division. And they've got the Nationals about 45 miles south now, and that team is going to steal some of those Oriole fans, and the Orioles have to put a fun, entertaining, representative product on the field. I think they're going to be an awful lot of fun to watch, but I can't see them making the playoffs, not without adding significant pitching help in the offseason.
You said you felt that the Mets had perhaps the most dramatically successful offseason in terms of players acquired. Which other teams have dramatically improved themselves since October?
Well, I think the Diamondbacks certainly have, just because they were so terrible last year that they didn't even put major league players out there at five or six positions for most of the year. They spent an enormous amount of money on Troy Gloss and Russ Ortiz and a bunch of other guys in order to become a decent club again. I think they'll be a decent club. I don't think they're making the playoffs, but they did a lot to get better, and so did the Yankees in the end. They added Carl Pavano to a rotation that severely needed it, and then they took the pressure off of Pavano by adding Randy Johnson, who at the top of that rotation gives them the ace they had to have, and it tells Carl Pavano, you can take your $9 or $10 million a year and quietly slip into this rotation, really help us without having being the man and the pressure that comes with that.
Finally, Tim, last fall, for the first time in nearly a century, the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, and it's still great fun to say that. Until that happened, the possibility that Boston would finally win had been a subtext for an awful lot of baseball seasons. What are the best candidates to replace that storyline this year?
Well, I think it's time now for the Cubs to win the World Series. I've said for years, why can't we have a Cubs-Red Sox World Series so one of these teams can win? Well, one of them has now, and I think it's the Cubs' turn. Frankly, Bill, I was getting a little tired of the Curse of the Bambino storyline. Thank goodness we don't have to deal with that anymore. Now this goat tradition or whatever it is in Chicago, it's time to bury that one too. I always root for the story, and this will be a great story if the Cubs can win.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine, and he offers his expertise to Only a Game from time to time as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
The NHL and its Players Association broke off talks on Thursday after no progress had been made toward ending the lockout, which is now in its 150th day. After the four-hour meeting, NHL Chief Legal Officer Bill Daly said, quote, I can tell you unequivocally and without a doubt that we are done. Union Senior Director Ted Saskin said, we're not going to pick up the phone this weekend. We're done. The NHL had targeted next Tuesday as its so-called drop-dead date for the season, but the laugh track has been cued, and it appears that an official declaration would be a silly and long overdue formality. Still, despite the current mess in which the league finds itself, the lockout has been a mixed blessing for at least one NHL star who has at least one spur in another sport. From Arizona, Greg Eklund reports.
At a recent workout with 13 other NHL veterans at the Alltel Ice Den in Scottsdale, Phoenix Coyotes winger Shane Doan got a taste of what he misses most about the NHL.
I miss being in the dressing room with the guys, and as you get to play, as the season goes on, the group gets tighter and tighter, and it's a unique feeling to have that, and so that was something that I really missed.
Doan began his hockey career in Winnipeg in 1995 and became a Phoenix Coyote when the Jets folded the following year. The 28-year-old Doan is the last original Coyote. Last year, in his ninth season, he scored 27 goals and tallied 41 assists, both career highs. At 6'2 and 216 pounds, Doan is regarded as one of hockey's tough guys, not one to mess with in the corners. Doan explains what that role requires.
Definitely is playing through pain, being able to not get hurt. There's an element of toughness in the fact that, you know, you're going to get hit, you're going to be beat up, and being able to get back and do it again.
Over the last 5 months, Doan and his fellow NHLers have had their collective toughness tested while their union and the league struggled at the bargaining table. Doan says the Players Association is prepared.
It's going to test how strong you believe in what you're saying. Obviously, as a union, we're saying, you know, that we want to play the game, but we want to play it on a fair CBA.
Doan was raised by a family rife with athletes. Five members of Doan's family, his grandfather Muff, two great-uncles, and an uncle have been inducted into the Canadian Rodeo Hall of Fame. Though Doan might be looked upon by NHL followers as the type who would eat nails for breakfast, he says he chose the easy career.
In my family, you're either a cowboy or a hockey player, and I wasn't tough enough to be a cowboy, though. The whole lifestyle that they have to live, where going from rodeo to rodeo without really knowing, you know, how you're going to fare or what's going to happen in the next one, and having to take care of everything yourself and do the whole, you know, travel and drive. It's a unique, tough lifestyle. And, I mean, I was a little too soft to do all that.
Though Doan has no desire whatsoever to ride bulls, he foresees a life around horses once his hockey playing career is over. He grew up around horses on a ranch outside Halkirk, Alberta, a town of 150. He owns land there on which he keeps 35 horses. Combined with adjacent land owned by other members of his family, it adds up to more than 1,500 acres. Doan developed much of his strength on the ranch long before he ever stepped into the high-tech weight rooms of the NHL.
My weight trainer that got one of the strength and conditioning coach here at the Coyotes was, there's a picture of me throwing a calf the one time, and it's an absolute perfect form for doing a clean and jerk. And I got the absolute perfect form for it, and he's laughing. I got it's a big calf, too. It's probably about a 300-pound calf, 350-pound calf I'm throwing, and it's running, and I'm just grabbing it as it's running, and I've got a good picture of it, and it looks pretty neat. And you definitely develop a fundamental strength that you don't get in the gym.
Doan keeps two of his horses at a ranch outside Phoenix. There, he rides the desert trails with his 6-year-old daughter, Gracie, the oldest of Shane Doan's 3 children. She, too, is interested in rodeo. So Shane has been teaching her barrel patterns in preparation for her first barrel racing competition this month.
I'll do the pattern a couple times for you, okay? Set.
Though this instruction has its tender moments, Doan would like the toughness that runs in his family to be passed along to Gracie.
You definitely want your kids to have that element of grit and the determination, which is, toughness, I guess, is another way of putting it. But definitely you want your kids to have that good work ethic and that grit and the determination to do things that might not come necessarily that easy all the time.
More time on his hands this winter means more family time. For that, Doan is thankful.
No, I'm definitely not looking at it as a lost year. I've got an opportunity to be at home with my wife and my kids. We just had our third, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. I really have. I want to play. I desperately want to play. But at the same time, I got to be at home for Christmas, something I haven't had in 13 years.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Scottsdale.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Among the more intriguing competitive events to have transpired recently in the Dutch village of Sneek was the third annual Dutch Open, a lock-picking competition. Prominent among the competitors was Arthur Buell, a private detective from Hamburg, who is, by his own estimate, one of the most successful lockpickers of all time. Buell refers to himself as Arthur Meister and eschews anonymity. He wears snakeskin boots and a double-breasted zoot suit. His hair is styled into a mullet that hangs down to the small of his back. Of the allure of lockpicking, one of Arthur Meister's rivals, Julian the Champ, said at the Dutch Open, "A lock is an intellectual puzzle, like chess. When you feel pins click and the cylinder go, it's like a drug."
Oh, when I get home, I'm gonna change my lock and key. Believe me.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, NBA history, courtesy of the Coos. But first, the gap between former University of North Carolina basketball coach Dean Smith and current Tennessee basketball coach Pat Summitt is down to half a score. Summitt needs just 10 wins from her women's team to equal the number of victories to which Smith led his men's team. That's certainly one of the stat stories worth following in women's college basketball as the season streaks toward its tournament days. Joining me now to discuss that and various other developments in the women's game is Michelle Smith, who writes about basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's enjoyable to be here.
Under normal circumstances, or normal circumstances for Tennessee anyway, 10 more wins this season wouldn't be a problem, but will Coach Summitt have to wait until 05-06 to overtake Coach Smith?
You know, it'll be interesting. They have some more SEC games left. There are certainly some SEC tournament games, and then I guess it depends on how deeply they go into the NCAA tournament. You got to win 6 in a row to win it all. So, you know, I think it's going to be close. I think that the SEC's competitive, LSU, I think is clearly the best team in that conference. It's going to be a race.
You mentioned LSU, which beat Tennessee on Thursday night by 10 points. One of the big stories that evening was that the women's game drew about 15,000 fans, while LSU's men's team the previous night drew about 5,600. I gather that wasn't exactly a surprise.
No, you know, there's been a lot of support in the last couple of years, particularly for the LSU women's team, and their run to the Final Four last year was really well received. And then, you know, frankly, Tennessee's coming into town. And, you know, they kept talking on the telecast about how people were out early in the day tailgating before the game and that, which is something that doesn't happen a lot, frankly, in women's basketball, with the exception of a few very localized places like Knoxville and Stores, Connecticut, and that. But it was a very fun atmosphere, you could see from the TV, to have that many people in the stands.
You're stealing my questions from me, Michelle,
because
I was going to move on to the fact that on Wednesday night, the University of Connecticut sold out Gamble Pavilion for the 88th straight time. UConn beat Boston College by 25 points that night. Four nights earlier, the Huskies set a Big East record for fewest points allowed when they beat Providence 71-24. Have the heretofore disappointing UConn women discovered themselves?
You know, possibly. I mean, I don't think, you know, Providence is probably not one of the better teams in the Big East. I guess we're being nice there. And Boston College lost its best player. Jesslyn Devaney is gone for the year. She blew out an Achilles tendon last week, and she's done. And I saw Boston College out here when they played Stanford, and they were a very good team, and Devaney a very good player. So I think that Boston College is probably trying to right itself after losing Devaney. And, you know, so maybe Connecticut's getting back on track, but I also think that who they're playing right at this point is probably helping them along.
Maybe the battle for the championship of New Jersey has always been a big deal in New Jersey, but I'm not sure how many people outside of the Garden State would have been aware of Rutgers beating Seton Hall Wednesday night if Rutgers wasn't in the top 10 this season. How do you like their chances come tournament time?
Oh, I like Rutgers very much. You don't beat three top 10 teams in a week unless you're a good team. I mean, there's certainly a lot to be said for momentum, but Rutgers could definitely figure in this picture. I think there's about a dozen teams that could figure into the national championship picture fairly legitimately. I think it's going to be a really interesting tournament, and Rutgers certainly is among that group.
My favorite recent statistical story in women's basketball found Sandora Irvin of Texas Christian University breaking the NCAA Division I women's career record for blocked shots last weekend. Her 434th blocked shot, which came in game number 116 of her career, put her over the top, so to speak. Ms. Irvin is also TCU's career scoring and career rebounding leader. So what do we do, write her off as a ball hog?
Yeah. No, you know, it's interesting because she is the niece of Dallas Cowboys football player Michael Irvin.
Mm-hmm.
And she was profiled in Sports Illustrated this week and apparently has a very large wingspan in addition to being a very big girl. And
6'3", I think.
Yes, and then I think the wingspan is even longer than that, and she's apparently got just this nose for the ball, and that's something that you can't necessarily teach, but clearly it's, you know, showing itself in the stats after the end of every game.
Elsewhere on the women's basketball landscape, Stanford, Duke, and Michigan State are among the teams that have prepared for March by winning more than 20 games through mid-February. Have you got some picks for teams that have been less successful to this point but might be terrific in the tournament?
You know, I think Texas is having a hard time for whatever reason, but I just, you know, that is a good team, and I think that in the tournament they could do well, and they've got quite a few losses on the docket right now. I don't think, though, that that's indicative necessarily of what Jody Conrad could have this team doing, you know, in a few more weeks. The Big 12 tournament is certainly a big test. Kansas State I like very much, another Big 12 team, with Kendra Wecker and Lori Kane, and, you know, again, a bit under the radar. They're having a very good year, but it's not Kansas State's not one of those schools, again, that rolls off the tongue when you're thinking of that. You know, and then I guess I'm going to give a little West Coast plug for Stanford in, you know, and I know you mentioned them as kind of teams that are at the 20-win level, but as our coach Tar Vanderveer likes to say out here, everybody's asleep by the time they're done playing their games out West, and maybe they're not seeing that this is the best Stanford team that I've covered in, you know, 8 or 9 years, and they're very good and I think going to be very dangerous in the tournament.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. She joined me on the line from that city. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
In a new biography of Bob Cousy, Bill Reynolds writes that in its early years, quote, professional basketball had all the glamour of a smelly uniform stuck in some old gym bag. Then Reynolds contends that Bob Cousy, who played in the backcourt for the Boston Celtics from 1950 until 1963, was, quote, instrumental in changing that image. Joining me now is Bill Reynolds, the author of Cousy, His Life, Career, and the Birth of Big Time Basketball. Bill, welcome back.
Good to be here, Bill.
And also with us in the studio is the man about whom Mr. Reynolds has written, Bob Cousy. Mr. Cousy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. And if he'd smelled my gym bag, he wouldn't have thought that that I changed that, because it sounds reminiscent.
Anyway, I want to start with an event that happened 45 years ago when Lenny Wilkins was a rookie with the St. Louis Hawks. Wilkins stole the ball from you, Bob, at least according to this story. He was called for a foul that he didn't think he committed, and when he looked askance at the official, the ref said, "You can't take the ball away from Bob." Bob, how many other players enjoyed that sort of protection?
That sounds like complete fabrication. I don't know if we can believe anything we've got in this book.
But, well, here's the guy who wrote the book,
right beside Lenny Wilkins' book.
Okay.
He might have made it up, but it came out of his book.
Bob, you had an exceptional rookie year with Boston, which must obviously have delighted your coach at the time, Red Auerbach, though it may have also embarrassed him, since he was not initially happy about having you on the team.
Yeah, that story, God, has been overdone over the years, Bill. I used to try to take Arnold off the hook constantly, and to this day, for that matter, because I keep saying, you know, if I'd been in his position, when you were building 50 years ago a team on a professional level, or today, you normally start with the big people. He did. He went with the percentages. He went with Charlie Scheer, this big 6'11 hulk of a center who in those days was a prototype, you know, and it just didn't work out. But Waller Brown, God bless him, who was a wonderful, wonderful man, the owner of the team, and who always told the truth, would get up at every luncheon for the next 2 or 3 years with media luncheons, you know, and would announce at some point, and I'll tell you how smart we were, pointing to he and Arnold, and we didn't want that guy, and he'd point to me. And, God, I would get under the table because I knew it must be grating on Auerbach, you know. But he did the right thing. Hey, it worked out for the best.
The remarkable thing about the way Auerbach is presented in the book is, even way after it was apparent that you were going to be tremendously successful in Boston, he was saying, "Well, yeah, but if I hadn't had the opportunity to mold him into the kind of a player he became, he would have been a wild man out there. He would have ruined the team."
Yeah, and I think that's Auerbach. I think this comes through the book. He's a contrarian by nature. You say black, he says white. You say white, he says black. And I think it's also, I mean, I think there was a tremendous ego involved, obviously. Well-deserved in retrospect, but a tremendous ego. And I think that his relationship with Bob Cousy was, I think, I'm not saying it was complicated, but I think it changed. I think it evolved, and they were together for so many years. They were linked together, but I don't think it was ever buddy-buddy, because I don't think that was the type of relationship that Auerbach had with anybody.
Bill, you write that one quality that distinguished Bob Cousy's play from the playground on was his determination to make his teammates better. He knew, you write, quote, "the key was to play the right way." What qualities go into deciding that that's the way to play? How do you discover that?
Well, I think that's the playground world that Cousy came out of. It's very different. It's a very different world today, where today in every playground in America, it's all about
showtime.
It's showtime. It's upstaging somebody. It's dunking on them and pointing at them. But I think in that era, back in like 40s in New York, it was a very different way to perceive basketball. And it was to make your teammates better. It was to be a good teammate. The worst thing anybody could be called back then was a ball hog. Mm-hmm. So you weren't brought up to show attention to yourself. Totally different era.
And you learned it early, Billy, because, you know, my first experiences in the schoolyard was as one of the little guys as opposed to the older guys who did the choosing of who was going to play. And if you were shooting all the time as a younger guy, you weren't going to get chosen.
Nobody wanted you.
It was a matter of survival.
Reasons behind, you know, everything that's being done. But if you wanted to play with the big guys, you better give them the ball. You know?
The other thing I think that comes across is that I think for children of immigrants back then, which is what Bob was, which is what a lot of those kids were coming through those New York playgrounds, I think schoolyard basketball became a metaphor for life in America. Mm-hmm. Winners stay on the court. You have to compete. You compete to survive. You compete to get to the next game. You compete to get to the next day. And I think that him especially, but I think a lot of them came out of that experience with certain qualities.
Bill writes in the book that at the time you retired from the Celtics, you certainly could have kept playing. What motivated your decision to retire in 1963?
Finances, you know, everything. As I say, the ghetto experience, you know, I came from a family that, well, I hardly saw my father. My father worked 18 hours a day. It was cute because we went back to this little farm in La Chapelle in northeastern France, and we went to visit the farm that my father, thank God, left. I mean, we're talking about earthen floors, no electricity. They had to go out to milk goats to give us a little bread and cheese and milk and so forth. And I'm thinking to myself, because even then I had been told, wow, you were born 20 years too soon. Obviously referring to the escalation of the salary
structure. Salaries later on, sure.
You know, and I'm thinking, hey, if I'm born 20 years earlier, I'm, you know, picking potatoes on that farm without any electricity. I mean, so the frugality of that life early on, I'd hate to see waste in any form. It's amazing how those things, those lessons, you know, stay with you.
You coached the Boston College basketball team, helped build a fine program there. You coached in the NBA as well. But in the book, Bill writes of your experience that, quote, the obsession with winning, the need to keep winning, was a distortion of values, his phrase. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, we see it demonstrated, God, on every level, politically, in the business world. There are five CEOs being prosecuted as we sit here, you know, for this kind of abuse. And I won't bore you with what goes on in college recruiting, but it's
somehow
obscene.
I don't think it would bore us. But
yeah, but it's obscene, Bill, you know. And we don't know the half of it when there's this much money at stake. So I found myself when coaching at BC, you know, where the pressures, once you start doing well, the first year we did poorly. There was no pressure at all the second year. Second year we did very well. So the third year you had to, and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth. So the need to continue to do as well or better, you know, and what will you do to make that? And you're getting subtle pressure from the athletic directors, the alumni, the presidents, et cetera. And especially if you get the thought that this is what everyone else is doing. If you reach that rationale, it doesn't take long before you say, well, now I've got to do for the good of the school. You know, I got to do
right.
It. There's always a rationale if you think a little bit about it when you're doing something wrong. You know?
Bill, you write at the end of the book, quote, Bob knew the NBA was all out of whack, the money, the glorification of the players, the distorted values, all of it, at least in part because, again, I'm quoting, for him, it had been about survival. But isn't it still about survival for some of the players struggling at least to make it to the NBA? They're coming out of circumstances as grim as the ones that you came out of, certainly.
Oh, I think a lot of it's survival. And I think with him it was very much so. I think the difference is that nowadays a comparable player at a young age makes so much money that that survival aspect soon leaves. With a lot of these kids, they sign that first contract. It's not about survival anymore. In this era, you know, the era that's portrayed in the book, it was a lot about survival. It was about everybody's on one-year contracts. There are no agents. RBAC kind of controls who makes what and all of this kind of stuff. So I think guys, maybe not the absolute stars, but I think everybody else was very much concerned with survival and how much can I, you know, prolong my career and can I, you know, get a few more years out of this deal. Because back then, I don't think anybody was playing professional basketball thinking this was a lifetime job, that if I do this for 5 or 6, 7 years, I'm never going to have to work again for the rest of my life, which is what everybody thinks now. You get right. to the NBA, and it's like a lifetime pass.
If the numbers had been what they were now, I would have played till I was 41 years old. Literally. It was that simple. I was getting a little stressed out with the traveling and all and the pressure of trying to stay number one and whatever. But it would have been neutralized completely if I'd been earning. I often say I was the highest paid player in the league in 63. I earned $35,000. The highest paid player a few years later, a guy named Michael something or other, earned $33 million for one season. Well, if I'd been earning anywhere close to $33 million, I'd still be playing now. Bill.
They'd have had to drag you off the court by your feet.
Oh, wow. Right. Screaming and hollering all the way. Yeah.
It's almost what happens now. Does anybody ever retire, really? No one retires.
No.
No, they just they get cut. They get cut eventually.
Bill Reynolds is the author of Cousy, His Life, Career, and the Birth of Big Time Basketball. Bill, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And Bob Cousy is, of course, the subject of the book, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Bob, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me, too.
Pleasure, Bill.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, curling up with a good Bond spiel. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me on the line from Cleveland for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
City of light, city of magic.
I was going to say, what has brought you there?
the endless chase of LeBron James, of course.
Well, though the Super Bowl occurred 6 days ago, stories connected with it continue. Do you think Philadelphia quarterback Donovan McNabb was A, sick, B, tired, C, sick and tired, or D, none of the above?
I don't know. Perhaps he was sick and tired of wide receiver Freddie Mitchell. he certainly did behave with a certain lack of urgency
down the stretch, right. Maybe he thought there was another quarter left.
I mean, it's possible he thought there were five quarters in the game.
You'd think that the result of the Super Bowl might have quieted chatty Eagles wide receiver Freddie Mitchell, the aforementioned. Yes, on Wednesday he said, quote, "I don't think nobody cares about the game anymore. The advertisers who paid about $2.5 million for a 30-second spot will be dismayed to learn that, don't you think?"
Well, I think he wanted to be more specific. I think he meant to say nobody inside Freddie Mitchell's helmet cares about the game. The Patriots cared about the game.
Yes,
I suspect
indeed.
Donovan McNabb cared about the game. Terrell Owens cared enough about the game to run on a busted-up ankle.
Will you join me in wishing that somebody, anybody, would just put the NHL season out of its misery right now?
This is the easiest joke in the world to make, so naturally I'm going to make it. We are yet confronting another drop-dead date, and I wish they would all drop dead.
There you go. I guess it was just a matter of time, Charlie, but scandal has enveloped the world of women's college basketball. Ohio State, of all places, is investigating allegations that a booster provided free dental work for two members of the basketball team there. Where does it end?
Ohio State is an amazing place. I get the feeling if you went out in front of your frat house and played catch with one of your friends, you could get $150 from somebody just passing by. Is there any athlete on that campus that somebody didn't pay?
The second to last of the undefeated men's college basketball teams fell on Tuesday night when Boston College lost to Notre Dame by 3 points. Do you agree with me that the worst aspect of this story is that Digger Phelps predicted it?
Yes, and no question it's the worst aspect of the story. Digger Phelps is an ignorant cowhead whether he's a writer of a basketball game or not. This was one that you could see coming, though. This is the kind of stuff Notre Dame lives for. Undefeated team coming into their place. Boston College is still one of the seven or eight best teams in the country, and I suspect they'll bounce back pretty properly.
The NBA announced its All-Star reserves this week, and I'm happy to say that Manu Ginobili made it because
it means I get to say Manu Ginobili. So you get to say?
Manu Ginobili.
There we go.
Are you surprised by who's in and who's out?
Not really. I think they did a pretty good job. I think the biggest disappointment, of course, is that the game is in Denver and that Carmelo Anthony is not playing in it, having had a pretty up-and-down season, mostly down. I mean, let's face facts, Bill. The way to launch your multimedia career is probably not on an anti-snitching video from the local drug dealers.
According to TNT sideline reporter Cheryl Miller, her brother Reggie Miller will retire after this, his 18th season in the National Basketball Association, all of those seasons with the Indiana Pacers. So, Who succeeds him as the last of the great shooters?
Well, I think you got to look at Michael Redd in Milwaukee. You got to look at Fred Hoiberg. But I think there's nobody who has the ability to come off a screen and go right up and set himself and shoot the way Reggie Miller does. And, of course, I'm sure Cheryl got this from sources close to Reggie at the Thanksgiving table.
Yeah, that's great. It does help to have access, doesn't it? Speaking of NBA greats, will Hakeem Olajuwon's plaque at the Basketball Hall of Fame eventually read, quote, voted one of the 50 greatest NBA players / international terrorist?
Well, I think that's a little bit harsh, but this is a very, very strange story. The United States government is very serious about these charities, and he has really gotten himself tangled in a mess here. I mean, one hopes that he can extricate himself as cleanly as possible.
It strikes me that for people as high profile as Hakeem Olajuwon, you know, you say yes to a lot of people who are trying to get something from you, and something like this could happen.
Yeah, that's part of it. But the other part of it is you have to be awfully careful who you're giving money to. And if you're going to run one of these things and you're going to donate money, you've really got to vet the foundations it goes to.
Meanwhile, the WNBA announced this week that Chicago will get a franchise, and it will not be directly connected to the NBA's Chicago Bulls. So, an indication of the league's maturity or a danger sign because the Bulls weren't interested?
Well, I'd a little bit of both. I'd like to think the former more than the latter. I mean, the one thing that I think the WNBA has run out the string on is associating its product with the actual NBA. It was good for a start. It gave them a great promotional kick at the beginning, but now they're starting to look like little sisters, and I think this is probably a promising development.
Charlie, we learned this week that the bloody sock worn by Curt Schilling when he pitched Game 2 of the World Series is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, are we dangerously close to the realm of relics and bones here?
We are dangerously close to pieces of the true cross. Of course, the San Diego Chickens outfit is already in there. So I guess once you've passed that barrier, anything's possible. Don't you think you would have washed the sock by now, though?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no bodily fluids on the Chickens outfit as far as I know.
I mean, the only other more famous bloody sock is, of course, the one that figured in the O.J. trial, and that's not going to go in the museum anytime soon.
Recently, in the North German town of Halberstadt, Gerhard Brinkmann, an 88-year-old former boxing champion, knocked out a young man who tried to hold him up. When the mugger regained consciousness, he ran away, and Mr. Brinkmann said, "Unfortunately, though I can still put up a good fight, I can't run like I used to."
See, this is what happens when you stop doing your road work when you're 68. Your legs go.
Last year's Super Bowl halftime show featuring Janet Jackson generated 500,000 complaints from television viewers regarding her alleged wardrobe malfunction. This year, the FCC reported only 2 complaints relating to Sir Paul McCartney's set, which 2 people apparently regarded as boring. I guess he should have played silly love songs instead of Live and Let Die.
Helter Skelter. I told him, go with Helter Skelter. You'll have the audience in the palm of your hands. Would he listen to me? No. He never listened to me. I said, don't fire Pete Best. Look where that got him.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Nobody has complained that he is boring. And come to think of it, nobody's ever complained about his wardrobe either. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Our discussion of the Super Bowl during last week's program included conversation about the range of restaurants in Jacksonville, Florida, where the game transpired. This provoked a cuisine-oriented call to the listener line.
This is Bonnie Anderson from Warwick, Maryland. You Northeasterners need to stop whining. It really does get annoying. The Waffle House is an institution. People look for those yellow and black squares all over the South. You guys really need to get out more and get a life. Bye. Love the show.
Chuck Strins, who hears only a game on KNOW in Minneapolis-St. Paul, emailed as follows, "Great show, but how do you do a segment about the Super Bowl's host city without going out on In Jail in Jacksonville?" From the late, great former frat brother of our president, Root Boy Slim. Charlie must know about this. If he doesn't, he must be told. Santina LaCava of Hopkinton, New Hampshire, and Diane Wanick, who hears the program on KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, were among the listeners who asked why this year's Super Bowl haiku weren't on the website. They are available now at onlyagame.org. Robin D. Gill of Key Biscayne was the most energetic correspondent sending actual haiku this time around. He sent 14, although he began his email by saying, quote, "The drumming in the background was great, but the poems, well, On the other hand, Rob Nordell, a Boston listener, emailed to say, "The haiku made me do it. Go to the keyboard and thank you for only a game. You don't have to follow sports to love OAG." Mark Mayall, who identified himself as a regular listener, wrote to take issue with my contention in last week's program that heptathlon champion Carolina Clift was the only athlete at the Boston Indoor Games whose name was featured in a song before she competed. During the distance races that involved Ethiopian athletes, Mr. Mayall wrote, a song in Amharic by Ethiopian artist Teddy Afro called Anbesa was played to rousing effect. This song was written after Kenenisa Bekele's triumph in the 10,000-meter race at the Athens Olympics and describes his exploits in the race. Should you wish to reach us with a correction, a music suggestion, a question, or a comment, our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. And you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. In 1995, the NHL's Winnipeg Jets moved to Phoenix and became the Coyotes, a development which many Canadians still rue. In an amusing reversal of sports fortune, some Arizona residents are turning to another Canadian import. Arizona Public Radio's Mitch Tyke recently spent an evening with members of the Coyotes Curling Club in Scottsdale. There he learned that you don't necessarily need a cold climate for good curling, but it helps to have plenty of transplanted northerners.
I am a curler.
A curler.
We are curlers.
Curling is catching on in some unlikely places. The Midwest accents and USA Curling's promotional spot notwithstanding.
I like the people.
Curling is the best.
The 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City helped increase the visibility of several winter sports in the United States. Freestyle skiing, snowboarding, and women's hockey have all seen surges in popularity since the Winter Games. And then there's curling, the art of sliding a 42-pound granite stone on ice towards a target.
Since the 2002 games, we've grown about 15% and added over a dozen new clubs.
Rick Patsky is a spokesman for USA Curling. He says even with that growth, there are still only around 13,000 registered curlers in the United States. But what's especially encouraging to him is that the sport is attracting people from places besides typical curling hotbeds like Wisconsin and North Dakota.
We've had a young surfer girl from California after the Olympics who begged their way into a curling camp in Wisconsin the next summer. They had two guys from Florida who just saw curling on the Olympics, and while everybody else was heading to Florida for their spring break, these guys drove to Bismarck, North Dakota and watched the World Championships.
And so it was in the fall of 2002, still basking in the glow of Salt Lake City, that curling enthusiasts in Arizona decided to see if there was enough interest to start a club. They held an open house at the Altel Ice Den in Scottsdale and hoped 40 people might show up. They got 160, and they're still coming. The Coyotes Curling Club takes over the hockey rink at the Ice Den every Saturday evening. Many of the core members of the club are transplants from the Great White North. Karen Tate is the club's president and a native of Edmonton, Alberta.
Well, we all came from, well, most of us came from a curling background and have been looking for a place to curl probably for years, myself 20.
Like many experienced curlers, Tate says she enjoys the finer points of the sport, the strategy, the technique, even the atmosphere of the ice rink. But Tate believes the Saturday night curling sessions in the Valley are an important link for her and her fellow curlers from the north. Daryl Horseman is originally from Calgary. When a job offer brought him to Phoenix, he brought his curling broom just in case.
Well, I think it's a little corner of whatever means home to you. Curling was a fairly large part of my social life, I suppose. You know, every Friday, Saturday night, you know, you meet a lot of good friends, a lot of the same interests, a lot of actually different people, a lot of interesting stories. So I truly did miss it.
But there is a limited number of expatriate Canadians in the Valley. Horseman says while he and the other club members take their curling seriously, they also understand the need to attract newcomers.
The majority of us who have curled a long time want to see the sport develop, and we want to train new curlers. And you know, we've all started out not knowing, you know, which end of the broom to put on the ice. But we just want to see the sport continue. So it's not competitive. We like to obviously have fun and obviously try to win, but it's not our overall goal.
Still, there are relatively few people in Arizona with even a casual knowledge of the sport. So the club's Learn to Curl nights include instructions on how to throw the granite stones and other curling basics.
And so there may be two or three rocks.
Yeah.
Right in here.
Yeah.
And you tell by color, you tell who's closest to the button.
Recruiting is another issue. A flurry of media attention helped when the club first started, but now they rely on word of mouth, along with relatively rare TV ads from the U.S. Curling Association and the movie Men with Brooms, the Bull Durham of curling movies.
It is just a rock.
No, it's not just a rock.
No?
No. It's 42 pounds of polished granite, the beveled underbelly, and the handle a human being can hold. And it may have no practical purpose in and of itself, but it is a repository of human possibility, and if it's handled just right, it will exact a kind of poetry.
Believe it or not, that movie was partly what brought John Mullins out to a recent Learn to Curl night, that and his neighbor, who's a member of the curling club. Mullins says he hasn't been disappointed.
I like the technique, and it takes a lot of technique, a lot of concentration, and the tactics used to move the stone.
Mullins enjoyed himself, but he says the hunched posture required for curling stone delivery might be too rough on his back for him to become a regular. But the club's oldest member, 72-year-old Hal McGrady, believes even if only a few novices stick with the sport, the Coyotes Curling Club has a bright future.
The reason this club's going to make it is because we have a core of curlers who know the game, have played the game, love the game. And all we need is to get somebody to come forward with enough money to get us started in the facility, and we could grow this in this area. Absolutely, no question about it.
And if nothing else, McGrady says it's appropriate that after 500 years, curling has traveled from its humble origins in Scotland to this improbable destination. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Curling is good fun.
So leave the club.
And this is how it's done.
And join a club.
There's nothing that's at all unorthodox. Sliding down the ice.
For mates or spouses.
It can be so nice.
Aim for two houses.
Be careful with the hand that cradles the rock. The stone slows to a creep. It's time for you to sweep. You didn't calculate the right amount of weight to hurl. Gradually you learn.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Bob Cousy, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from ESPN baseball guy Tim Kirkjian.
All right, Bill, good luck, and I'll see you at that Mexican place in April, okay?
Whoa, what a scoop! Major League Baseball expands to Juarez, and you heard it here first. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Adios.
And the hero who can curl always gets the girl. She tells the friend she phones that he plays with the stones, and she will be his bride. Together they will slide. He will naturally sweep her off her feet.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.